Okay. So, sorry about my absence for last 2 weeks. I was being kept busy by a project that I had to finish, which is done now. So, now starting this week, all my energy can be put into the lecture now. So, yay. This week we will do the lecture today, and then in the exercises we will do a lecture instead, so that we will get them synchronized back again. Okay, today I will walk you through the Intel architecture, so the development of the Intel architecture and their newest chip that's available. Tomorrow we will do the an alternative x86 implementation done by AMD with their Zen architecture, and then I will introduce the NVIDIA's GPU architecture. Okay, so let's start with Intel. So as we so it's all messed up on the slides. Okay, so what we've heard in the past lectures was Moore's Law, right? And I think I mentioned that Moore was one of the founding engineers of Intel, right? So, and the interesting thing now is that the different generations of Intel architectures obviously follow Moore's Law very closely, right? Because why not? So, what you can see is in the past that we have this tick-tock kind of thing, which was introduced by Intel's marketing, where each tick introduced a new microarchitecture. Sorry, each tock introduced a new microarchitecture, and each tick then is an optimization for the a specific microarchitecture. So the background here is if you, I'm sorry about the displacement here, but if you look here, you have always two pairs for the same manufacturing process, right? So it starts with 65 nanometers, and the reason behind that is that they introduced a new microarchitecture only after they had the tick, right? So we had the NetBurst architecture manufactured at 65 nanometers. After that, we got the next tock with a new core microarchitecture with the same manufacturing process, right? 65 nanometers again. So, and this pattern continues and eventually stopped in the last 8 years. The idea behind is that we introduce a new microarchitecture, right? Once Intel was confident enough that they are able to actually manage the new technology, the new manufacturing technology, they moved on to a smaller manufacturing process, but only as an optimization for the previous microarchitecture generation, right? With this pattern, they were able to actually increase or decrease the transistor length almost, well, every year, every 2 years or so, right? And this eventually stopped at, well, yeah, 2014, 2015, with 40 nanometers, right? 40 nanometers is quite small, so the two main factors were there. First of all, it was getting harder and harder to decrease the manufacturing process of the transistors, and second of all, there was no real competition, right? So AMD back at that time was having a few troubles, so they weren't able to actually So they weren't able to actually compete with the Intel architectures, right? So except for some notebooks or so, there was almost no AMD processors sold, at least not in the server market. So there was no real economic reason why they should continue with that pattern at that pace, right? So that's why we more or less are still, well, not only the reason, but one of the biggest driving factor to not actually push the physical limits, because they were so successful with the architectures, right? So I think most of the laptops sold nowadays are with the Kaby Lake architecture. Cannon Lake was introduced in June this year, I think. This is where we are at the moment. Okay, the Kaby Lake and Cannon Lake microarchitectures are currently only available for workstations or laptop machines, and there's no server architecture available. The latest server architecture is for the Skylake microarchitecture. Okay, so this is just to give you a brief overview on how the Intel process worked previously. Okay. So, the Intel Nehalem architecture, which was introduced here in 2008, is what's more or less the foundation for all succeeding designs. So, one of the big steps which they made here is to introduce a very modular setup. And for that, the architecture consists of a few basic building blocks. I mean, if you listen carefully, all those things have been more or less discussed, except for those three last things. But obviously, every processor needs some kind of cache and some kind of memory controller. The new thing is that they try to really build up a modular design such that they can easily replace cores, replace the size of the cache, different memory controller, and so on. And that means that they gained high flexibility to create different CPU models with the same microarchitecture for different scenarios, right? I mentioned that for some microarchitectures, there isn't a server version yet, right? But only a laptop or workstation version. They obviously have different needs, right? On a laptop or workstation, all I want to do is start my web browser and office application and or play some games. And in that scenarios, the requirements aren't that high as for a server application where multiple virtual machines or some scientific computation needs to happen. Okay, so right. So the example now is that we look at a very basic Nehalem quad-core processor. So using that block diagram, what you see is that we have four cores on the chip, right? And they have each core has a level one and level two cache, which is private to the core. And then those four cores share one bigger level three cache. Okay. This level three cache communicates with something called Quick Path Interconnect, okay, which is connected to the I/O hub, so input-output hub, so to communicate with the outside world. In addition to the connection to the QPI interface, we have the integrated memory controller, which has three channels to communicate with DDR3 memory. Right? So this is the basic design. And what you might see is that this kind of design can be seen in almost every CPU design that's available today still. Yeah.
The
L3 cache is between the level two and the main memory. So this is the main memory.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So this is all on one CPU, right? And then you have the connections to the outside world, either through the main memory banks or through the input-output hub.
But with the main memory, like for example, the hard drive is in the part of QPI or EMC?
No. The hard drive is not main memory. Okay, so the hard drive would be in the domain of the I/O hub. Okay, so there would be some extra hard drive controller with which
there's not the main memory, which is the main memory, the DDR.
DDR is the main memory. Yeah, double data rate memory. Okay, this is the one which you access when you do a load or a store operation.
Yeah, the RAM.
Okay. The RAM. Yeah. I will probably never talk about hard disks, okay, because it's so far away from the processor.
Okay. It's good to know.
It's good to know, yeah. Yeah, so usually it's somewhere below this I/O hub level. Okay. So the other interesting thing is that, so if you look at how the instruction stream is being decoded is we have a change from the previous architecture to the new architecture such that instructions may not have to be decoded anymore, right? And they are stored in a so-called loop stream detector or loop buffer. That means that if we execute some kind of tight loop, right, the processor is actually able to detect this loop and doesn't have to go through the whole branch prediction, fetch, and decode phase, right? But can directly detect such a stream at the end of the decoding phase, right? So usually what happens is that the processor tries to predict whether, so first of all, the instruction has to be a branch to begin with. If it's not a branch, we will just fetch the next instruction, right? And if it's a branch, we will ask the branch prediction, hey, what do you think? What's the next instruction? Okay, then the instruction is being fetched. Then we have this loop stream detector. That means that we detect the loops on the basis of the regular instructions that you see from the assembly level, then we decode the instruction and move on, right? And with this change, we move this loop stream detector behind the decode phase, right? Which means that we don't necessarily need to decode the instructions anymore, but can actually work on a micro-ops basis. So those are the instructions which are being decoded into several micro-instructions. Okay, which are then being executed by the processor. We will have a more detailed diagram about that later on. And then the micro operations are directly fed into the processor if such a loop is detected.
But one question: the loop have to how do you say complete once, like for the stream detector to have all the instructions stored and then repeat again without going to the branch?
More or less, yeah. 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 So you can detect certain patterns in the code, okay? Which means that it doesn't necessarily have to be executed because you can detect the pattern if it's loaded. So we talked about caching, temporal and spatial locality, right? If you look at code, right, that's also kind of data, right? And which has to be loaded from main memory as well. Okay, this means that when we load the instructions, we also load it on a cache line basis. Okay, that means that once we load an instruction stream consisting of, for example, 64 bytes, that means that we can look at the instruction stream on the processor level. Okay? And of course, there are a few ways how you could write a loop, right? But there is a certain pattern that most of the compilers use to generate loops, okay, and the processor is able to detect those, right? It might not be correct, right, because the loops might only be, so the loop body might only be executed once, right? But it's able to detect some patterns there.
Mm-hmm. But if the loop is different from the usual pattern, then will be an error? Or what?
No, it won't be an error. It will just be slower. Yeah. Okay. The other big change here is the energy management. I think the Nehalem architecture was one of the first which really had a overall energy management unit, and it could observe the temperature and voltage of all single cores. Okay, not just the whole package, but all single cores. And the other interesting thing is that it could get it can individually adapt the clock cycle and voltage of the different cores, right? Depending on the requirements. And requirements there means, is the core idle? Does it do a lot of work? What about the other cores? And so on and so forth. That means that single cores can actually be put into energy saving modes. And this unit is actually rather complex, right? So it has about 1 million transistors in this architecture, which is nice, and also kind of answers the question, what do we do with this huge transistor count that we have available with each new generation? Right. So with the previous, with the Core 2 architecture, the voltage and frequency had to be set globally, okay, so that all cores had the same voltage and the same frequency. And this is kind of inefficient because most of the time the load is heterogeneously distributed among the cores, okay? Except if you run some OpenMP loop or something. But most of the time in regular operations, for example, when I show you this presentation, probably only just one core is active when I switch the slides. And once the slide is visible, the core doesn't need to do a lot, right? It's just the GPU which has to constantly refresh the video buffer, but the CPU can be put idle, right? And if I switch the slides, then only one processor needs to work, right? That means that my other core on this laptop can be idle, okay, or can be turned off. And there are different stages for the energy saving modes. Again, this is just for the Nehalem. The generations that came after Nehalem actually improved on this energy saving quite significantly, especially regarding the wake up time. Nevertheless, the general scheme still applies. So the idea is that we have four different states that we are in. And the different states have different characteristics. First of all, depending on whether the clock is active, so the processor is running. Processors only consume memory if the transistors switch, right? And if the clock to the processor is turned off, they don't do anything, right? So they don't consume power. The difference between the reason why in the states C1 and C3 we still have power consumption is that the caches are still active here, right? So the caches are also built with transistors, and the transistors need to be refreshed constantly to not lose their values, right? So that means that we still have some kind of power consumption. Since we clock down the caches here, we also have different wake up times, right? So if we are in the C0 state, we are active. That means that we don't need to wake up anything, right? And if we just turned off the clock cycle, we have a smaller wake up time than if we also flush the caches. Okay, so that's the basic message here. The more we turn off, the longer it takes to turn it back on again. But also the idle power of the core is reduced significantly. Right. So this helps with saving energy. Okay. The other interesting technology is that we have the so-called turbo boost technology, which means that we can overclock single cores if possible. Okay. What does it mean? What does this mean? Well, if you remember the motivation for multi-core processors, right, where we had to kind of deal with the physical limitations and thermodynamic limitations and so on, is that we had to suddenly increase the number of cores to actually deliver more performance. However, the problem here is that still, even today, most of the applications are still written for a single core. Okay. But if a company like Intel or AMD or IBM wants to sell new chips, right, they need to give the customer some new benefits, right? So that the office application is running faster, that I can have more complex applications running, right? And this turbo boost technology is one way out there. So the idea is that if only one core in the processor is active, okay, and all the others are idling, this means that my thermal capacity on the chip, that I still have thermal capacity on the chip, that means that I can temporarily overclock the single CPU by a short amount of time, right, until it maybe overheats, and this single core application is being boosted. Right, so the performance of the single core application increases. Okay, that's the basic idea. Okay, so if the power control unit detects that our thermal budget that we run under our thermal budget, we can actually increase the clock frequency to some degree. Okay, make sense?
And then you overheat, change to other CPU.
No, the single core heat is only increased.
That's why, but when it's overloading, it changes or it stays with the same core.
It stays with the same core, but the processor has to take special care that you don't overheat, that it doesn't overheat the entire chip, right? So if you if you look at the history of CPUs, right, especially at the history of workstation and laptop CPUs, right, most of the time until the early 2000s, we only had one single core, okay? And the performance improvement, the biggest performance improvements that we got from one generation of CPU to the next generation was by more or less increasing the frequency, okay? That means that the software architects really didn't need to do a lot, right? In order to exploit the new capabilities of the new chip, right? So they just invested time into single core performance, okay, which made sense, right? And it's also easier, right? It's way easier to write a single core application than to write a multi-core application. And not all algorithms are actually parallelizable, right? So that, I mean, look at some GUI applications, right? It might make sense to have two threads, right? Where one thread just waits for the user input, and the frequency of the user input is so low, right? I mean, you can't really type at a few gigahertz per second, at a few gigahertz, right? It's kind of slow compared, or it's significantly slower than the cycle time of a CPU, right? So that means that this thread more or less doesn't require any CPU time, right? And also reacting on the user input, right? It's usually also very fast, right? If I click the arrow keys here, right? The transition from one slide to the other, there is not a lot of not that much work to do, right? So reading out the next slide, rendering the text, pushing it to the GPU, right? So it doesn't make a lot of sense to parallelize that, right? And that means that a lot of applications are written with a single core in mind, right? So JavaScript is single-threaded, right? Your web browser is very interesting because, of course, getting the loading the web content, right, and then rendering the web content, it's kind of single-threaded, right? But however, that's actually a very interesting thing. If you look at your web browser, right, you might have multiple tabs open, right? And that means that, of course, those tabs might run some application in the background, right? And this means that even though your web browser is inherently single-threaded, so a single tab, right? By having multiple tabs open, you turn it into a multi-threaded program, more or less, right? And also, if you look at, let's see. So another interesting thing is if you look at the, one second, performance, I think it is. No. But then I'm, yeah. If you look at the timeline on when the different material is arriving to the to my client, to the web browser, it's interesting that the actual transfer of the data is happening in parallel, right? But at the end, we still need to wait until the very last image appeared, and this can be still most efficiently done on a single thread, right? Where we just have this event loop and wait for the different actions to come in, right? And that's more or less the reason why most of the applications are still single-threaded, right? Let me see. So if you look at the activity of my different processes running, you can see that most of the processes are not doing anything, right? And only some of the processes consume 2%, 3% of CPU time, right? Which is almost nothing, right? And they can be multiplexed pretty nicely on a single thread as well. And if you look at the actual system load, so this laptop here has two cores, and each core has two hyperthreads, and you can see that the load is not distributed equally, right? So that means that a lot of applications run on those different cores, right? Which is also the reason why the workload in the processes isn't really homogeneous, isn't really homogeneous, right? And if I, for example, start a an endless loop here, okay, you can see that one core is increased, right? And I can do it again. And the second core, which one? CPU 1, right? And this means that this little program here, this little bash program here is inherently single threaded, right? Although it uses all the CPU time, right? But I can start multiple ones at the same time, right? Which is and my system is still responsive, right? So no, but it consumes all the CPU time. Okay.
And if you run more than four, what will happen?
Let's try it.
Another machine
question. Okay, so now I think I started four, right? One, two, three, four. Okay, and everything's still running and responsive. Okay, so how can it be 100% and I can still use my computer, right? That's the magic of operating systems. So you can so here you see that those bash programs consume a quarter of my CPU time, right? So this is essentially, so one core is, so 100% would mean that the application would use all cores, okay? And my operating system, on the other hand, is able to, so the operating system still is the manager of all the processes, right? After, I think, 10 microseconds or something like that, it stops the process that's running, right? And schedules the next process. Okay, you can see that I have quite a few applications that might come into a ready state. So those bash programs are always in a ready state, right? Because they don't do anything, right? So that means that my system is still responsive. And if I start yet another one, nothing changes, right? But now they kind of try to share the resources on the system, right? So the power, so the performance of each of those processes is just being shared among the others.
So what will happen is that the for loop will be made in a slower way.
Yeah. Right. Okay. And now, oh, come on. Okay, and I can actually look at the power states that my processor is in. Okay, so I should stop those processes. Okay. So
so like you told that the OS system plays an important role in the distribution of the which would be better, that we have more advanced operating system and an older CPU, or an advanced CPU and older operating system? Which would be us a better decision?
So the question is, if I understand correctly, which would be better? One operating system which manages all CPUs?
More advanced, let's say Windows 10 and Pentium 4.
Mm-hmm.
And a more and in the second case, a more advanced CPU, but let's say Windows 8 or 7. So which will give us a better result in the terms of management of CPU?
That almost doesn't matter. Okay, what I wanted to show you though is that I can actually read out the different states that my processors are in, right? So I don't know why those bars are turning up. They don't show up my screen. So you see that this is a Skylake processor that I have in here, and you can see that I have way more CPU states that I'm in, right? And so I can look at the different frequencies that my process, that my different cores are in, right? Unfortunately, I can't increase the size here, but you can do this experiment with your machine as well, right? The tool is called PowerTop. I'm pretty sure there's a Windows equivalent for that as well, but I don't know. You can see that if I do nothing, right, it actually clocks down pretty significantly, right? And the maximum frequency is actually 2.3 gigahertz, right? So that's quite a significant decrease in performance, right? And if I start my endless loop again, right, the effect should be that one of the cores, so you see now that one of the cores is at 2.6 gigahertz. Okay, that's turbo boost, right? That means that since every other CPU is at a lower frequency, the thermal budget isn't reached yet, right? Which means that now it's at 2.8 gigahertz even. And so the newer generations can also overclock the other CPU cores as well. Okay. And the operating system is automatically switching the process to one core to another, right? Such that we have an equal distribution of loads. So let me try to pin this one. This is a demonstration that I didn't plan for. Oh, come on. What did I do wrong? Oh, come on. Okay. 1 second. Okay. All right, now it should only be at those two, I think.
The turbo boost, yeah.
Once it's kicking in. Oh no. Okay. Too bad. Didn't work. Anyways, that's the basic idea, right? So.
But one thing to continue the question, they were asking that in the operating system, for example, within the operating system, whether Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 10, the management of the CPUs haven't changed too much, or did it really change?
Oh, it did. It did. Yeah. So, for example, the management of the CPUs and how you assign a process to a CPU, it's called scheduling, right? And the scheduling algorithms have changed significantly, okay? So one example is that, I think I can talk about it. So one example is that, how you could handle is that if you have a queue where you have the different processes running, okay? So process 0, process 1, and so on, right? So all these processes are ready to run, right? And I have different, okay. Better? And I have different CPUs, right? Right. And now I want to assign, so now what's happening is that on each of those CPUs, something like a scheduling loop is being run, right? So something that needs to continuously look at this task queue, at this process queue, if a process is ready, and to get a new process, okay? That means that the access to this queue needs to be mutual exclusive, right? So that I don't get race conditions. So if both CPUs try to access this shared queue, right, bad things happen. So this is something which has to be accounted for, right? And if I increase the number of CPUs, right, this doesn't scale, right? Because then every CPU is essentially the execution in this phase is essentially serialized, okay? And so what's being changed is that we just add more queues, right? To avoid this contention, we also can account for we can choose different processes. We can actually make kind of educate, well, it's not really guesses, but we can design algorithms to choose the best process that should be run next, right? And so on and so forth. We have different priorities of the processes, and so on. Okay. So.
And this happens in Linux and in Windows the same. So both operating systems, the CPU management not change.
Yeah. Yeah. The scheduling usually changes. So in Linux it's more transparent. You can actually look it up. So on Linux there are different schedulers. Okay. Give me a second. If you're interested, I can show you. I forgot where it's at. Okay. I can show you tomorrow, okay? I'd have to look for the maybe I'll find it very quickly. Ah, yeah, there it is. So when you build the Linux kernel, you can actually configure it, right? So this is the menu on how you would configure your Linux kernel features, right? And it's been a while since I've done that. I'd have to look for it myself. No, sorry. Ah, okay. Okay. I forgot where it's at. I think it's somewhere here. Okay, so you can, Okay. I forgot where this is being selected. Yeah.
Don't worry. Let's continue.
Let's continue with the lecture.
Yeah.
But I want to know now as well. Anyways, you can look it up at the on the internet.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So let's continue where we left off. Okay. So this how this power saving works now is clear to everyone. Okay. Or at least the basic idea. Okay. So the other thing that that I mentioned very briefly is hyperthreading or simultaneous multithreading. Okay. So the idea is that instead of having the cores here, which have physical, which are physically completely distinct. So each of those cores have a set of registers, their own program counter, their own caches, etc., their own execution units. The idea is now to introduce number of logical processes with dedicated register sets and a dedicated instruction counter. Okay, and the logical processes share some resources. So most importantly, the resources that they share are the execution units. Okay, and what we get there is a pseudo parallel execution of several threads. Okay, the background here is that different threads mostly have no data dependencies on each other, right? So that means that the execution units can be better exploited to get a better total throughput. To give you one of those Intel marketing slides overview is that if we have one physical processor, right, and one logical processor that's visible to the operating system, is that we first need to execute thread one, right, and the yellow tiles here represent stalls in the pipeline. So that means that the processor has to wait for something, right, in order to execute thread one. So we have different resources, and the processor eventually has to wait until the computation or loading or whatever the operation has finished. So now with hyperthreading or with hyperthreading technology, we can actually tell the operating system, hey, instead of one core, I actually have two cores, right? But it's not really two cores. They share the same execution units and caches. Okay, this means that whenever the execution units are idle, we can interleave the current thread that's being executed with the other thread that's being executed. This means we can potentially double the throughput. Okay, and how this looks like is that on the system monitor, we saw that my machine has four cores, right? And what's actually in the machine is that I only have two cores, right? And on each of the cores, I have two processing units. That means I have two-way simultaneous multithreading, two-way hyperthreading, right? That's the reason why we saw four cores earlier. All right. Okay, and the other thing that's interesting is that obviously it doesn't necessarily improve the performance by a factor of two, right? Because we only share, we still have some shared resources, we still didn't double everything. And this graph here is for illustration purposes, right? Where the yellow line is the core 2 generation of microarchitecture. The red line is the Nehalem architecture with multithreading, with hyperthreading disabled, and the blue line is then with hyperthreading enabled. Right? And So what I find interesting is that for most benchmarks, the performance improvement isn't really that good, right? So there's almost no performance improvement. And for some benchmarks, we also have some performance decreases, right? Which is kind of interesting. It's a new generation. There's supposed to be a performance improvement, right? However, once the hyperthreading is enabled, we then get a performance gain again with the different benchmarks that have been run there. Right? So potentially there is some potential when using hyperthreading. Okay. The other thing is the other important change is how the memory controller is being accessed, or even the physical location of the memory controller. I don't know whether some of you tried to build their own PC once. Back in the time of the Core 2 and earlier microarchitectures, the choice of the main board was very, very important. Okay. The number one reason for that was that the memory controller was actually on the main board itself. So it was provided by the main board manufacturer. Right? With the Nehalem architecture, this changed. The memory controller actually moved into the CPU. Right? So the choice of the mainboard manufacturer is still kind of important, but not that significant in terms of the memory controller itself. The advantages that we got from this decision to move the memory controller from being external to the core to being internal to the core is that we have a lower latency to access the memory controller, and of course it's independent from the mainboard hardware. Whether that's a advantage or disadvantage is different question, but still, right? And the biggest points are really that we get lower latency and higher bandwidth compared to Core 2, right? So this is the Core 2 architecture, and this is the Nehalem architecture, right? You see that the frequency of the main memory is actually lower than for the Core 2 architecture, where we have the 1.6 gigahertz frequency, and here we have the 1.06 gigahertz. And you see that we have the for the two channel setup, we get a 4 gigabyte increase, comparing to the faster main memory, right? And if we compare the three channel setup, we see that we get a further increase. So we got a very nice increase of performance. The latency speed up that we got is almost two times, right? Which I believe is a very nice improvement here. Okay, so the next thing is the Quick Path Interconnect Bus, or in short, QPI. And the purpose for this is a fast and direct communication. So the main purpose is a fast and direct communication between the processes. Okay, so the Nehalem architecture supported multiple chips to be able to communicate with each other. Okay, so the design was that we had a point-to-point and packet-based communication channel, communication bus, which is being used to either communicate between the different chips, and in addition to that, to the input-output components. Okay, the former. So previously to that, we had this front-side bus, right, where we had a different chip on the main board as well, which was supposed to communicate with the different components in the system. With QPI, this again moved into the chip, right? So the role now is that the two chips can actually directly, or more or less directly, communicate with each other. Okay, and what you see here is that each of those chip still has have their own memory channels. So if we have this dual chip or dual socket layout or architecture, we can see that the actual memory channels that we have has increased from 3 to 6 in this example, right? Which means that the potential data rate that we can achieve, the bandwidth that we can get from our main memory has doubled. Okay. Right. The cache organization for the Nehalem architecture is that each of the cores has a own level one cache. So we have 32 kilobyte for instruction and 32 kilobyte for the data in each core. Each core, in addition to that, has a 265 level two cache and a large level three cache. So that means that 8 megabytes for the quad core architecture. And what's interesting, however, is that the latency to the level one cache actually increased by one cycle. However, the level two cache latency decreased by 7 cycles. Okay. Just minor thing. Okay. The organization of the cache is in such a way that the cache is a so-called inclusive cache. This means that if I access data in level one, that means it's always in level two and level three as well, right? So that means that if one cache line is not in level three, in the level three cache, it can also not be in the cache of another core. Okay? Make sense? Right. So, they share they share the level three cache, right? So imagine that core zero accesses some data, right? So it looks in the level one cache, it's not there. It looks in the level two cache, it's not there. Level three, it eventually loads it from the main memory, and then we know that it's in the level three cache, level one, level two, level one of core zero. Okay. Now imagine that core two actually tries to access this data as well. Okay. Now it looks in level one, it's not there. Now it looks in level two, it's not there. However, in the level three cache, it's actually there, right? And now the question is, what should we do, right? Do we just propagate the cache line from the level three cache up to the level one cache? What happens if core zero changes the data, right? Yeah, let's see how that's being solved. Okay. This problem is usually called cache coherency. Okay, that means that once we have this shared resource, we somehow have to make sure, we either have to make sure that the cache, that the data is in there, is coherent, such that every time we look at one of those cache lines, we know exactly what we can expect from the data, or we don't have such a requirement. That means that we can't easily synchronize between the different cores, right? We have to implement something, some different mechanism to synchronize between the different cores. And since the cache is kind of this transparent memory that's between the main memory and our registers, the requirement is that the access to the cache is actually coherent. Okay, that means that we need some kind of protocol in order to ensure the coherency of the data that's inside the cache. I think one of you actually asked about the MACI protocol. Okay, he He's not here. So what we need now is what the Nehalem architecture has is the so-called MESIF protocol. This means that each cache line actually has a additional state, right? And those states are modified, exclusive, shared, invalid, or forward. So this is one way to actually manage the when a cache line needs to be evicted, when a cache line needs to be reloaded, etc. And it's also the communication protocol to keep the different to keep the state of the shared level 3 cache coherent. And not only the state of the level 3 cache that's on one chip, but also via the QPI interface with the level 3 cache on the other chip. Okay, so what we have is that when we load a data from the cache on a single core, we get the exclusive. We get to set it exclusively. Okay, that means that the line is only stored and it's identical with main memory, right? So we just did a read on some cache line, and we own it exclusively. Okay. Another state could be the shared state, right? Which is an extension to the exclusive state. The extension is that another processor might have a copy of that line as well. Okay. Now, if we modify this line, so if we do a write operation, for example, we need to mark the line. So the content in the cache might not be the same as the corresponding line in the main memory, right? So we have to have some protocol, some communication going on that when we go from shared to modified, for example, or from exclusive to modified, we have to notify the other processes to put their cache lines to invalid to read it back from main memory. Okay. So that's the basic idea, to have some kind of protocol that the caches are coherent. Okay. Okay. So in the beginning, I mentioned the modularity, and if you look at Intel's portfolio, you are overwhelmed with the choices of different CPUs that you can make, right? And then the Nehalem was the start of it, right? So you had different choices for the frequency. You have different choices for the amount of cores on a single chip. You have different choices for the size of the level 3 cache, right? Whether there's a turbo boost going on or not, whether you have hyper-threading enabled, whether you have an embedded GPU, the different manufacturing process, and the different thermal design power. Okay, so this is just to give you a small overview, and it's getting the different choices are getting more and more, right? And it's actually very interesting because the price spans between the different CPUs is so massive, right? If you buy a top of the line Intel CPU nowadays, I think it's around 1 or 2,000 euros, something like that, and the cheapest ones, I think, I should have looked it up. I think 400 euros or something, 200. Yeah, so it's the same architecture, but different features, right? And the features then determine the actual price count. Okay. So what most, I think most Intel processors nowadays are going to be Skylake processes in the HPC systems. So the newer HPC systems start to get a Skylake processes, but most contemporary HPC systems, supercomputers have Haswell, but we will move on to the Skylake architecture right away. So this is just a annotated die shot of a Skylake desktop processor, right? And what's interesting is that we have four CPU cores, one rather big level 3 cache, right, and a huge amount of space on the chip is actually dedicated to the graphics processor. Okay, so that's just for the desktop variant. The server variant actually looks more like this. So this is a blurry image of a die shot for Skylake server chip. And can anybody wants to take a guess what, why is it so blurry? So anybody wants to take a guess what, which component is here? So I find it very nice since it looks so so regular, right? So we have the same structure here and here, right? Same structures here, and yeah, it's spread over the entire chip, right? And what you can see here is the so we have the CPU tiles, okay, and integrated memory controller tile, okay, and here we have the physical connections to the now DDR4 memory, right, and over here is the I/O interface for the to communicate with the outside world, right? So we have PCI Express channels. Now they switched the name from QPI to UPI, right? I think it stands for ultra path interconnect. And on the server die shot, you don't see any GPU anymore, right? So the entire space is dedicated to the CPUs, right? And what's also interesting is you don't see the dedicated last level cache there anymore. So the microarchitectures, essentially we want to have bigger and wider cores, better instruction per clock, and improved power efficiency. So for the desktop chip, we have this block diagram here where we have the different last level 2 caches. We have this interconnect between the cores, okay? And the basic idea is that the last level cache, so the thing that we had is attached to a embedded DRAM thing, which is able to improve the lookup in the last level cache furthermore, right? So we either have the eDRAM based addition to the last level cache, or we can use the entire 2 megabytes per core and have an additional cache between the memory controller and the system agent. Okay, so what's interesting, however, is the actual increase in the different regarding the on-chip parallelism, the instruction level parallelism that this architecture introduced. So the out of order window is 224 micro operations. That means that one single chip is able to select the next instruction on a window of 224 instructions, which is quite big. We can have quite a few load and store operations that are in flight. That means we just dispatched it to the memory controller and we wait on it. The CPU itself also has a scheduler so that it knows which operation to schedule next. And we also the amount of available registers also increased significantly. At least for, well, not significantly, at least to some degree. Okay. So what we have in terms of the front end, that means the part of the CPU that actually gets the instruction and decodes them and dispatches them to the different execution units at a very high level, is that is more or less the same that we saw on the Nehalem architecture, where we have at the very top the branch prediction, then we have the instruction cache, we decode, then we have this thing called microoperation allocation. That means that we allocate it either to the execution scheduler or the memory scheduler, right? And the execution scheduler then decides on which execution units the actual microoperation is scheduled on, and the memory scheduler decides on which memory channel and memory controller the instruction is scheduled on. Okay, and of course, deeper, wider, and better. Okay, so hey, I'm not sure why my slide's missing. Okay, anyways, so what's pretty cool is this page called wikichip.org. Okay, and this website has extensive information on the different architectures that are available. Okay, and I wanted to show you the page for the Skylake server architecture, right? And what you see is, first of all, you have a different product lines, right? So you have the D, W, bronze, gold, platinum, etc. Different amount of cores again, right? So the variety of the different products that are available increased, right? But I think the most interesting part will be how it looks like. So this is a schematic of how it works, of the chip itself, right? So not like what we had here, where we have the die shot and the annotated die shot, but now we have a diagram that's more digestible to us humans. Okay, and what you see here is that this is the 8-core variant, right? Where we have the integrated memory controllers on the left and the right. And what you see here is, in addition, are those brown, or for you, black lines, right? Those black lines connect the different cores in a so-called mesh fashion, right? That means that, so previously, the QPI interconnect, on previous generations, the different cores were attached on a so-called ring bus. So to illustrate, if we add here, another CPU, how they were communicating previously was through a so-called ring bus, right? So if they needed to communicate with each other, they just put a signal onto that ring bus, and then you had a more or less complicated protocol which determined whether the bus is free, or if one of the cores could actually put something on the bus. However, this ring structure is not really scalable, right? This means that for the higher core counts, they moved on to a mesh interconnect, right? This means that in this design with the ring bus, the processor 1 could more or less directly communicate with the processor 2. Right, by just sending a signal over the bus, and it just needs to travel the certain length of the wire here until it reaches the CPU 2. Now, if this core wants to communicate with this core or with this memory controller, it actually needs to hop over the different mesh connectors here, right? And the last level cache, so the level 3 cache, is also completely distributed among the cores. Okay, that means that for sure the different cores can access the last level cache, but they need to go over this mesh interconnect to get to the different parts of the chip. Okay, so this is the 8-core variant, and it gets even more complicated with the 14-core variant, I think, where we have even more cores. And you see that this mesh structure that we saw earlier is very easily extensible, right, by just adding 8 more cores at the bottom. And there's no there's a reason why we can't just add more and more cores, because we don't have enough space available on the chip. But theoretically, if we would just add more and more cores over there, we can easily extend this mesh network here to add more cores, right? And this is done with the extreme core variant, how they called it, right? Where we have 24 cores available. And the interesting thing, at least for me, is that the amount of channels to the main memory actually didn't increase, right? So we just increased the number of cores, right? But didn't increase the actual bandwidth to the main memory. So the question now, how does it look in the roofline model? So the bandwidth is just getting more and more of a bottleneck, unless the last level cache and the actual bandwidth and latency to the main memory controller is being able to keep up, right? However, what's being scaled up in contrast to the smaller core count versions is the number of external connectors to PCI Express and with the UPI links. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. Now, how does it look like when, I promised that I show you a more complex diagram on how it looks like the front end, so when an instruction is being fetched and decoded. So this is a more complicated diagram here. So we have the level 1 instruction cache, right? Which is able to produce 16 bytes per cycle to the instruction fetch and pre-decode window, okay, where we just fetch the next instructions, decode them, and put them into an instruction queue, and then put them into a so-called 5-way decode unit, where we have simple decoders and one decoder for more complex instructions. And we again have the branch prediction unit, which selects the correct instruction that we got. And we have of course have the decoded stream buffer, which we discussed earlier, which is essentially this loop detection buffer. And with this multiplexing unit, we can actually select which instruction we want to get out of those different entities in the system. Okay. Once the instruction is being processed by this front end, which only purposes to decode the instruction and feed our execution engine, is we get our allocation queue, where we then get the different micro operations, right? And now we have to rename, allocate, retire instructions, reorder instructions, etc., right? And those instructions then go to the scheduler, and the scheduler has access to 180 registers for integer arithmetic and 168 registers for vector arithmetics, and this scheduler is able to serve 8 ports. So we have 8 groups of of execution units. The first one are mostly for integer arithmetic. We also are able to do floating point math and encryption and branch related instructions, right? And the there's one port which only purpose is for storing data. We have 2 ports which are able to load data, right? And one additional port to support our branch instructions, right? And those different ports means that we have a superscalar architecture, right? And together with the scheduler, which can reorder the different instructions, we have a superscalar out of order architecture with the Skylake. Well, the previous ones were the same, but I just wanted to demonstrate how this might look like. Okay. Right. So, yeah, this is how we can look at those diagrams. Okay. Okay. And on this wiki, we can also see the different properties of the memory hierarchy, right? Where we have the different values for the caches. So here we see that we have on the first level cache, we have an 8-way set associative cache, right? And the further down we get, which I found actually interesting, is the set associative level is actually increasing. Now we have a 16-way for the level two cache, and the level 3 cache is a 11-way set associative cache. Okay. Okay. Great. Any questions?